Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Ayman El-Mohandas, the Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and a senior consultant to the United States Agency for International Development. Dr. El-Mohandas' appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Asian World Center as part of the 7th Annual Asian Culture Week. This year's theme was Sustaining Changes in Asia. He'll speak on the topic Change in the Air, What is Next in the Middle East and Beyond. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 28, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Patrick Borchers, Professor of Law and Vice President for Academic Affairs at Creighton University.
It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ayman El-Mohandas. Dr. El-Mohandas is Dean of the UNMC College of Public Health. He's an expert in maternal and neonatal health and believes that no field of study requires more in the way of interdisciplinary work. And I certainly, although I'm not an expert in the subject myself, certainly agree with him on that. I think this is one of these justice issues, as we like to say it at Creighton, that really calls for working together across disciplines rather than just working within our own discipline. He is a senior consultant of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID as it's sometimes known, and as I said, is an expert in the reduction of infant and maternal mortality in resource-poor nations. As a practitioner, researcher, and educator, his vast experience includes providing public health services both nationally and abroad, including acquiring research funding to support vital public health interventions and studies, and mentoring MPH and doctoral students, residents, maternal and child health interns, and fellows. Sounds like a big job. Dr. El-Mohandas was born in Egypt. He's fluent in English, Arabic, and French. He has led and participated in global health projects in Egypt, Indonesia, South Africa, and other parts of the world. Very well known in his field, but is also active in Middle East affairs. In February of 2011, he gave a well-received talk on Grand Rounds that was entitled Egypt, Charting a Path for Renewal and Hope. The presentation was very well received, and I'd like to invite to the microphone Dr. El-Mohandas. Thank you.
Thank you for your very kind presentation, and most of all, thank you, Creighton, for your friendship. I must admit that I have been invited to the Creighton campus more times than I have been at UNO, so I'm thrilled and I'm delighted. I'm also a very firm believer that public health is a domain that is based on an enthusiasm by the community and a collaboration across communities towards common goals. And only somebody with no sight and no insight would assume that Creighton does not and will not play a vibrant and important role in maintaining the health of the community in Omaha, in Douglas County, and in the state of Nebraska. So it be told also nationally and internationally. So thank you for embracing me, and I send you back a collective embrace. Having said that, I will tell you, Egypt is not in Asia. So that makes me even more thrilled that I was invited to participate in your Asia Week. But this is a very exciting period in our history in Egypt, but also in the Middle East in general. And there is no question that Egypt in the Afro-Asian region was one of the first to adopt democracy as a solution. And as you know, we were a British protectorate since 1882, and it's a very funny terminology, because unlike India or other countries we know were under British rule, Egypt literally was not really ruled by the British and was not a British colony. But having the Suez Canal in Egypt inaugurated in the latter part of the 19th century, the Sultan, or the Khedive of Egypt as known at the time, borrowed against the Suez Canal from British and French banks and towards establishing modern Egypt of the 19th century. And he borrowed so much that at the end of the day, this very important venue and source of revenue was stripped of any Egyptian ownership. And it was, in fact, owned by British and French creditors. And as a consequence, the British decided that they would bring in their armies into the easternmost part of Egypt, bordering on Asia, maybe that justifies the talk today, to protect their economic interest in Egypt. And so Egypt became what was known as a British protectorate. As known historically, the British really tend not to exquisitely and singularly and specifically mind their own business. They meddled very actively in the way Egypt was governed, and to a point where it was seen that the Egyptian monarchy itself became a puppet regime under British influence. And I'm sorry to go into this historic level of detail, but what happened was in 1919, there was a very important Egyptian uprising. And Mustafa Kemal, who was responsible for leading that uprising, was really mainly centered around creating a clear Egyptian national character and involving the common man in the governance of the country. And so democracy was established in Egypt, a quasi-democratic system, inspired a little bit by the British democracy in the sense that there was, although we didn't have quite the upper and lower house, but we did have a parliament where there were about 210 elected members and 177 representing the big landowners. So the aristocracy in Egypt had a privileged participation in the Egyptian democracy, and big landowners continued to influence governance in Egypt to an extent that became less and less tolerated over time. But the reason I'm bringing up history as far back as 1925 was there was a multi-party system in Egypt at that time. And it is also interesting because if you look at the elections in Egypt between 1925 and 1950, although there could have been up to six parties represented on the seats of parliament in Egypt, the prevalent party, which was called the Wefd party, or the Delegation party, which was considered the predominant party in Egypt, the predominant party, the Wefd party, in general garnered somewhere between 82 and 88% of the seats of parliament. So the Egyptian electorate, how much ever you want to interpret at the time, because of course there was a majority of the population that was either through illiteracy or through economic dependency under a more empowered class of landowners and what we would call ayan or influential families. So the interpretation of what the vote really intended and how free the voting process was. But regardless of that, it was clear that the electorate generally tended to choose the most predominant or most powerful party. And that continued up till 1950, 2 years before the coup d'etat by the military in Egypt. The best known figure, of course, was Gamal Abdel Nasser, but also Anwar al-Sadat was one of the members of the leadership of that coup that came from the army. And that gives you a very important glimpse as to this history of the nation looking at the army to protect its rights in some way. But regardless of that, in 1950, the ultimate expression of discontent in the elections of 1950 was that 30%, an unprecedented percentage of the seats of parliament, went to opposition parties. And the WEFD, very crushed and despondent and self-examining, only got 70% of the seats. This gives you a glimpse, a cultural glimpse, into what democracy might mean for different people and how it is exercised. But there is no question that ever since the military governed Egypt, either directly in the very early stages after the revolution in 1952 or indirectly by having a president appointed from the military cadres, there was no question that the military from 1952 up till January of 2011 had a very direct impact on how Egypt was governed and what political direction it took. And actually, the financing of the army was a very, very important and relevant factor that influenced where Egypt was going and into whose embrace Egypt would fall. And in 1956, Egypt did something it called the nationalization of the Suez Canal, which meant that Egypt no longer recognized the ownership of foreign banks over shares in the Suez Canal, and that Egypt regained its total ownership over its Suez Canal, and that the revenue from the Suez Canal would go directly to the Egyptian government. And that, of course, caused a great deal of dismay, leading to a tripartite invasion of Egypt in which France, Britain, and Israel invaded Egyptian territory and bombed the Suez Canal. And at the end of that, the Soviet Union chose to take a very strong position. And those of you probably are too young to even recognize that historic event, but that was the only time when Khrushchev took off his shoe and beat it on the podium of the United Nations, saying that Russia would never accept that the foreign invasion would lead again to foreign control over Egypt. At that very same time, Egypt was seeking to build something it called the Aswan Dam. And the Aswan Dam that exists today, called the High Dam, was intended to preserve the flood waters of the Nile from being wasted in the Mediterranean at the end of the month of August and the early months of September. And those of us that have Alexandria roots and grew up around Alexandria remember very well that towards the middle of August you could never swim in the pristine waters of the Alexandria shores because the sea would be polluted with the heavy, mud-laden, very rich, soil-laden waters that flew from the Nile into the Mediterranean. That, of course, was wasted water. And as a result, most of the south of Egypt could only have one crop every year because the Nile River was never high enough to allow for irrigation of the eastern and western plateaus of the Nile. Am I getting into too many details for you, or is this an exciting story? But you see, today was born yesterday, and without understanding the origins and the backgrounds, it is very difficult to understand the present. And when I read, for example, an email that one of my colleagues sent me telling me that the Pew had conducted a poll amongst Egyptians to see how popular America is in Egypt today, the results, unfortunately, were not very encouraging. But that we will come to very, very quickly, because America historically has played kind of an interesting role in Egypt. And the first event that was particularly important was that the United States government refused to assist Egypt in building the High Dam. And the High Dam was seen as something that could double the revenue from agriculture in Egypt, because preserving the flood water would allow us to not only plant immediately after the recession of the flood water in the fall season, but would allow half of Egypt, the south of Egypt, because the delta had enough water the year round, but the south would then have water for a second crop in the spring, which it never really did have. And by so doing would double the revenue. And the United States took a position at that time that that the High Dam was an environmental disaster and that, no, we will not lend you money to build the High Dam. Now, guess who we turned to at that time, the Egyptian government turned to at that time, for a big loan? Any takers? The Soviet Union. That is right. And that is the very, very early origin of Soviet influence, real Soviet influence in the Middle East. And at that time also was born a movement in Egypt that assembled other countries around the world called a non-alignment movement. And the non-alignment movement included in its very origins Egypt, Yugoslavia, Ceylon or Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and India in its very, very origins. And the purpose of this was to defy the Western powers, the old colonial powers, to create a national identity. Now, all of these things are very, very important, because you will say to yourselves, where were these Egyptians? Were they, you know, somnolent from 1952 till 2011, when they suddenly realized that they were an oppressed nation? What are they, a bunch of ninnies? And the truth of the matter is, no. This was an evolutionary process. The first thing that happened in 1952 was the British left Egypt. In 1956, we regained the ownership of the Suez Canal. We went through a period where we fell into the embrace of the Soviet Union for economic purposes, and as a result, found ourselves entangled in a political and military game that was not very difficult to reverse, and unfortunately was not predicted intelligently enough by the president and his entourage, Gamal Abdel Nasser at the time, who assumed that a socialist solution might be a viable one. But also you need to understand that natural causes kind of eliminated a president after 14 years and then his successor, Anwar Sadat, after 11 years. So Egypt had never seen that rule of a despotic regime for 30 years as occurred under the rule of Hosni Mubarak. Nature was kind enough to close one chapter after the other simply by natural causes where these presidents died. And nobody assumed that we would be in a situation after 30 years of rule by somebody who was never seen by anyone as being particularly super intelligent or very talented or visionary or and in fact, when Hosni Mubarak, who was the vice president at the time of the assassination of Sadat, came to power, there were many, many jokes about him, and people called him Lavash Kiri, the cow that smiles. There is a little box of pre-processed cheese that is made in France and Switzerland, and it has a laughing cow figure on the face of the box. And most Egyptians called him that, the laughing cow. So nobody really took him very seriously, and nobody imagined that he would in fact rule the country for 30 years and have the audacity of assuming that his son would follow him. Something that we had not seen since the death of King Fuad and the ruling of King Farouk in the 40s. So the length of it, the transitional period after Anwar al-Sadat, the role of America after the Camp David Accord and the presence of the United States Agency for International Development, and you know, they keep saying, you know, the money that we've spent in Egypt, the money we've spent, it's just really a very small amount of money compared to the Egyptian economy, and most of it went towards armament anyway, so it wasn't like, you know, everybody was going to the market buying products that came from America at a super low cost or anything like that. And the money was channeled through the Egyptian government into projects of interest to them. And from time to time, you would see a bus or a truck or something that had the USAID symbol on it so that people would know that this is USAID. But the presence of USAID in Egypt outside of a very, very fortified building in one of the suburbs of Cairo was not necessarily very felt by the common man as something significant. But the presence of USAID was helpful because it did open doors and there was subtle pressure and the U.S. embassy size grew in Cairo, allowing for glimpses of freedom of speech and freedom in the media that were very frequently and repeatedly extinguished after being on a trial period for a short time where the government began to feel that people were going too far and nobody expected to be criticized by the media. Freedom of speech was supposed to be outside of the realm of criticizing the government. Naive as that might sound. So Egypt benefited from these consequential periods where people's voices were heard. And then with the opening of a new phase of a multi-party system, new parties started to develop and had some participation in the parliament, but never to a point where they could really exercise any significant legislative power over where things were going, or how laws were constructed, or the constitution of Egypt, or anything like that. So when the social media came in as an additional empowerment tool, there was a fertile ground of thoughts and a new generation of technically empowered and ideologically curious, a generation that most definitely influenced the occurrence of this uprising first in Tunisia and then in Egypt. And because of the quasi-freedoms, but more importantly, because of the presence of social media as a vehicle for communication, people are able to see a face of the government and its brutality that had never been seen to that extent before. And I must admit, how that particular video found its way to YouTube and was propagated amongst Egyptians of a common Egyptian man arrested and being sodomized with a broomstick during his interrogation was an excessively visually shocking event that is probably unprecedented in Egyptian history. And struck a nerve with many, many people. Now, let me tell you that torture in Egyptian prisons during the military rule, and I call it a military rule, it appeared very civilian to most people, but nobody links Nasser, Sadat, and Mubarak to all having been military people, all belonging to the same legacy, with very strong links to the Egyptian army or air force, and very dependent upon military support for the stability of their governments, with a behind-the-scenes group of very empowered senior military officials that, to some extent, influence, if not dictate, how things happen. So I call it the military rule. During that military rule, nobody had was ignorant of the brutality and the torture that occurred in prisons in Egypt, but nobody had seen it so graphically. And I don't know how many of you have actually seen that video. Has any of you seen that video? It is shocking, isn't it? It is powerfully shocking. And Egyptian people do have a sense of dignity. And a couple of years ago, long before the actual uprising in Tahrir Square, a word came up that had never been heard before in Egypt. You know what that word was? Kifaya. Enough. And it is astounding that the government didn't hear that word in its full context. That word started to appear verbally, started to appear in gatherings, started to appear in the syndicate of lawyers, the syndicate of journalists, in groups of people protesting in the written word, in graffiti, kifaya. Enough. And the justification of belonging to a stable system, which started with overthrowing the king, getting rid of the British, nationalizing the Suez Canal, building the High Dam, creating an international persona, supporting the African liberation movements, standing against the onslaught of an Israeli threat, an open market economy. All of these stages were happening over the evolution between 1952 and 2011. But starting around, I would say, 2007 or 2008, I started to sense, visiting Egypt frequently, that people felt there was no price, the price was too high to pay for their current predicament. And I must admit that although many Egyptians today sense the extreme danger in terms of destroying a quasi-stable economy, but most people would agree that this had to happen. Now, the assumption that democracy is a product that you go and buy at Walgreens is unfortunately not true. And, you know, some British philosophers said that, I think, democracy was a system that was created for a few thousand Greeks. But it is a system that requires an infrastructure. And although we have a tremendous race towards creating new parties in Egypt, I am getting emails from people asking me if I will join their party, if I will PDF them a copy of my birth certificate or something. It's very, very odd. There is that incredible movement trying to create these parties. But it is very, very difficult to discern the exact intention of these parties, what is their political position exactly, and where are they going with this, which puts us at a disadvantage because there are ideologies that are well circumscribed. Socialism was probably one of those. But definitely religious doctrine is another one. And I would not be surprised at all if religion doctrine did influence politics for a period in Egypt. I am not really of the opinion that Islamic fundamentalism, in the concept that the word fundamentalism is coined in the Western thought, is what's going to rule in Egypt. But it is plausible that somebody from the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, might rise to the level of presidency or prime minister in Egypt. It wouldn't surprise me at all. And I think they should throw their hat into the ring. I personally am not convinced that they are going to rule successfully. But unless people are allowed to try and succeed or fail, I don't think we can move forward. Question in my mind is, what role do we play as Americans? What role do we play as America in this new world of people that are, in fact, refusing despotic regimes in the Middle East? And how do we put the best foot forward? And I personally think that, in my opinion, after living in America for as many years as I have, that the American entrepreneur beats the American diplomat any day. Every day. All the time. And that the American diplomat actually is most of the time strapped with the safe position of representing the official policy. So it's almost secondhand talk. And is not necessarily the representative of what makes America great or what makes America special, which is our modus operandi, what we believe in, what makes our communities special, what makes our individuals brilliant. I didn't come to America because I was an economic refugee. I came to America as an ideological refugee. And it was people like Thomas Jefferson that captured my imagination. It wasn't a circulaire from the U.S. Embassy in Cairo that I read and I said, boy, do I want to join that team. In my opinion, delegating our role in these new systems only to official government representation will take away a lot from our ability to be heard in the way that is most helpful. And I think personal American ingenuity, kindness, caring, acceptance, but also entrepreneurial spirit, could capture the imagination of the common man on the street in Egypt. People said Obama should have stepped in sooner, he should have said Barack was a despot more quickly, should have opened the trap door right away. It's all said and done. And We have done this over and over, and political analysts will tell you, well, that's what went wrong with the Shah of Iran, and see where we are at now had we stood by him. A very, very brutal, despotic ruler. But people, revisionists today, are saying, well, you know, we should have stood by the Shah of Iran. No matter what his people thought of him, we wouldn't have had the regime that we have in Iran today. But they forget that history is a sequence of chapters. It's not made overnight, and people rehash history. And our biggest challenge is going to be how to create a new history for America in that part of the world. I would like to entertain a dialogue. Is that something that you do generally in the Asia Week here? Would you allow me to stop at this point? Maybe I've shown some of my cards, and then have people engage in a conversation. But I think at this point it might become more interesting if you ask questions or I ask you questions or something like that. Would that be all right? Okay. Does anybody have questions?
No microphone was available for the audience to ask questions, so we'll paraphrase them in order to maintain the continuity of the program. The first questioner asked about the condition of the Egyptian judicial system and what reforms were likely to be needed.
Well, the Egyptian judiciary, by tradition, have always been very respected. And I would say that it's only probably in the last 15 years that people have started to express their dismay at corruption within the judiciary. But we have a very, very long history of an independent and highly respected judiciary, and you probably would be respected more as a judge than you would be as a doctor in Egypt, or would have been. That is changing. The judges are not compensated adequately, and I think that is something that has to be looked at. But there is still a certain degree of respect. The judiciary were under a lot of pressure from the ruling party and the government to sometimes relent to government interest over justice. And some still are seen as steadfast and moral. And I don't think that this is going to be very difficult to reform. I think there has to be a relook at what judges make as judges. And if you really allow people to voice their opinion, the Egyptians are going to be openly critical if they think that this is a trend. But I can only in this matter speak for Egypt, because that is not necessarily going to be true in every single situation. But Egypt is blessed with a reasonable bureaucratic infrastructure that unfortunately has been corrupted in the last couple of decades, more so than we've ever seen. And it's going to be the reform from corruption. But these are problems that we see in many, many other countries, including South Africa. And should never be a reason for us to give up or not to try.
A member of the audience asked Dr. Elmohandas to comment on the state of the Egyptian health system, both before and after the downfall of Mubarak.
Well, it's very early to say what it's going to be like after, but there is a relatively well-established blanket for healthcare for the poor in Egypt. The question there is the quality. And the government has given free healthcare at the primary, secondary, and tertiary level for the last 50 years. There are many programs that are addressing improvement in the quality of healthcare given there. And there has always been a parallel system, quasi-compassionate, parallel private healthcare system that has provided healthcare according to a financial gradient to be determined by the provider and the user. But many attempts in the last 10 years have really focused on creating a quasi-Medicaid healthcare system and a centralized health insurance system, more like the French system, perhaps, where there is a central mechanism for collecting and reimbursing. And whether this will continue or not remains to be seen, but is a reasonable solution to have a health insurance system that reimburses for services and does not discriminate against private or public providers, allowing the market to determine where people will seek care. There has been a significant infusion of capital into the public system, for example, through USAID programs that I was involved in, and in certain instances have improved care provided in a significant way. But the government at this point is not going to be able to take responsibility for delivering care free of charge. So there have been attempts at cost recovery and so on. So these are all projects that are being considered. And I don't think there will be a sudden change in the attitude towards the finance of healthcare systems in Egypt. And I suspect it's going to be probably a system that has gradients of monthly insurance payments depending on where you are at in terms of your income, and with a security net for those that cannot participate.
Dr. El-Mohandas was next asked what the prospects of any government emerging in Egypt will have to influence the economy enough to provide jobs for the new generation.
Well, providing jobs, I mean, the concept that the government provide jobs has become so prevalent that we even expect it here in America today, strangely enough. But I'm not sure that in the new economy it's the responsibility of the government to provide jobs. I think it's a responsibility of the government to create an environment where the economy can thrive. And how it is going to be set in such a way that entrepreneurship is going to be encouraged and a free market is going to be encouraged will depend very much on legislation and laws and probably some changes in the Constitution. There are some infrastructural systems that are very, very defective, including, for example, taxation. And in Egypt, taxation only in the last 5 or 6 years has moved forward in a very, very significant way to collect. There's a very large zone in the Egyptian economy. It's called the gray zone. And the gray zone is not the black market and is not the white market, but there are a lot of transactions that are not monitored. There's a lot of cash transactions. And the government is, in most instances, is finding great difficulty at collecting taxes. So there are infrastructural issues. How is the government going to create jobs? I think the government needs to protect entrepreneurship, needs to encourage new industries, needs to encourage new initiatives. But I think the last thing I would like to see is for the government to continue the feeling of dependency on the government to create jobs. We have a masked unemployment of many, many people sitting in government offices doing nothing and being paid every month. That is not what I would encourage the future to look like.
An audience member asked for comments regarding Egypt's relations with Israel.
Well, I think relations with Israel go both ways, don't they? I mean, there is a sense here that it's just one side. Relationships are both sides. You know, what you do for me and what I do for you. It's very shocking for the common Egyptian man to see that the Prime Minister of Israel speaking of Hosni Mubarak in very favorable terms. It's kind of like, excuse me? Have you been sleeping at the wheel here? Or what's the story here? Why would the quasi-only democratic system in the Middle East stand up for a despot? And so there are a lot of people that are talking about this, thinking like, what is this message? This message is that we really don't care what happens to you so long as our interests are protected. And so this does not foster a good response. And, you know, when we hear about all these settlements that are continuing to be perpetuated against every rule and every advice from every direction in the world, I mean, you suddenly see something like the polls in Egypt show that the common Egyptian person is against Israel. Well, they're against what's happening more than, you know, Israel is not an abstraction. Israel is actions and responses. And I think this is a golden opportunity for Israel that, you know, I hope that this early declaration by its prime minister does not botch. But for the government of Israel to be seen as pro-despotic, so long as the despot is on our side, is just not the right position to take. And will influence people's behaviors and attitudes.
Someone asked if it was true that in 1956, the United States objected to England, France, and Israel opposing Egypt in the United Nations, and what happened subsequently to change the good relationship.
Yes, but timidly. By not participating in the intervention, in the invasion, rather than by obstructing it. Definitely the High Dam was a very, very important event that really created an entry point for the Soviet Union in the Middle East that made America very, very suspicious. And it was not a good thing. I mean, whether America needed to have supported that project in the south of Egypt or not, I'm not sure. It's very difficult to look at these things. The hindsight is 20/20. But it was a situation where the Soviet help to build the High Dam gave them access in ways that were not anticipated by the Egyptian and made America very suspicious and very cold towards the government at that time.
What brought us back together?
No question, the visit of Nixon to Egypt was an unprecedented historic event where spontaneously tens of thousands of people were out on the street saying, Nixon, Nixon, when in fact Nixon was in America. It was just like, you know, completely chopped liver. And it was astounding. It said something about the common person, how hungry they were to see that America could stand by them or cared about them. That was a very important turning point. And then, of course, the Camp David Accord and Anwar al-Sadat coming to power and Anwar al-Sadat being extremely popular with America and the presence of United States Agency for International Development, which entailed very large amounts of money being infused into the Egyptian military, and a growing relationship of many of the military who almost could not be promoted to the highest ranks without having come and gotten some training in the United States. So that really influenced in a very, very significant way the one-to-one relationships. Unfortunately, the gap that occurred was that some of these very senior leaderships were engaged in very shady practices with the Egyptian intelligence, for example. A good example is the person that Hosni Mubarak in his last political breaths appointed as his vice president, who was seen by many Egyptians as a man who orchestrated chambers of torture for many, many years in Egypt and was applauded immediately by the U.S. government as a very good man. And so people are left wondering, what is this about? Don't they know? Of course they know. And in fact, was very much involved during the Guantanamo Bay, the transitional stations of torture, where people were airloaded into countries where they were subjected to torture in order to collect information. None of this remains completely a secret. People hear about these things. Wonder, you know, what is this about?
The next question dealt with the general health and mental health of the Egyptian people.
Well, there's no question that when you live in poverty and under oppression, you're depressed. I think the Egyptians have a lot of manifestations of mental health issues, especially in the recent years, that are very significant, and not enough attention has been given to them. There's a lot of intimate partner violence inside of households, people who are very depressed and very angry. There are a lot of the chronic illnesses that we are seeing more and more of, including hypertension and obesity. Actually, Egypt is the capital of obesity for women in the Mediterranean region. And we continue to suffer from some of the health problems of emerging economies, including infectious diseases and parasitic diseases and infant mortality and lack of primary care. But we are also now burdened very significantly with diseases related to environmental exposures, such as cancer, as well as diseases related to human behavior, including smoking and obesity and lack of exercise and depression and anger and violence.
What was the impact of the high dam? Did it do what was intended?
Well, it certainly saved Egypt, yeah. It certainly saved Egypt during the drought years in Africa. That's for sure. When every other African country was in severe drought all around the Nile Valley, Egypt had enough water. But is it the solution to all our problems? No. The nature of the water that is emanating from behind the dam now is not as rich. We have to use a lot of artificial fertilizers that we never had to use before. There's a lot of erosion of the river bed itself and canals around it, which is a significant problem that we are suffering from. So it has its pluses and its minuses, like any of these very large projects that impact the environment.
Dr. El-Mohandas was next asked for his thoughts on the role of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood in the spectrum of Islamic political expression are considered very moderate. But during the early phases of the military governance in Egypt, during Nasser's time, they were extremely oppressed. They were tortured, imprisoned, banished, etc., etc. So they have that history of how poorly they had been treated. But nonetheless, I think for the Muslim Brotherhood today to be able to really govern in Egypt, they will have to govern with some degree of moderation. Whether they have shown a real economic and political platform that can be sustainable is very much in question. But they appear to be one of the quasi resistance or anti-government movements that could be adopted. But I must tell you that they did not play a primary or central role in the uprising in Egypt in January 25th, 2011, and are recognized as such. But they have a platform that's relatively well organized. They probably will be able to get reasonably good results during the upcoming elections, since they are relatively hurried, these elections coming up in September, in a system that's really not ready for them. But will they be able to rule Egypt for very long? My periscope tells me no. They're probably going to fall flat on their faces. And they're not going to probably sustain the economy very well. And it's not because they are particularly better or worse than anybody else. I think we need a totally new rethinking of how this country is going to thrive. And I'm not sure that there is a ready solution to this. You know, this is something that we'll have to learn to do. People will try, will fail. Another government will be elected. Maybe they'll come back again in 10 years. You know, but we have to have an environment where people need to test different ideas, see how well they work, and have the freedom to select their best choice.
What effect will the events in Egypt have in Yemen and other countries in the region?
Well, Egypt has always played an important role in Arab nationalism. And, to what extent people are responding to that message of freedom or autonomy or self-governance or democracy will be very, very dependent on the economic situation in these countries. It is very, very telling that the King of Saudi Arabia chose to give everybody a significant raise in their salaries just 2 weeks after Egypt gained its new government. What does this tell you? Does this tell you they're very comfortable on their thrones? So, you know, actions say a lot. And we do have a lot of regimes that need to rethink their relationship with their people, and people are hungry for self-expression.
What relevance will civic organizations have in Egypt?
There are a lot of civic relevance within societies and communities in Egypt. There is a civic awareness. There has been for a long time just sporadic involvement of people in expressing issues related to environment, the safety of the environment, health of women and rights of women, movements against female genital mutilation. There are a lot of issues, violence against women and children, homelessness, trafficking children, substance abuse. There are a lot of concerns that were expressed through civic society and concern for well-being. And I think if you watched the uprising on television, I was obviously glued to it 24 hours a day, I was impressed. They organized themselves. They put up these tents. They had their little sanitation arrangements. Those that were there said that this was Egypt at its best. And it was totally organized by people and not government. So the uprising itself can tell you something, that when they put their mind to it, they know how to do it in a reasonably workable way. This is a culture of 5,000 years, not unlike your own.
Finally, what was the effect of the United States Agency for International Development?
Actually, this is one of the things where I was telling you, USAID did have some influences in Egypt, good, positive influences, one of which was to channel money towards non-governmental organizations, for example. And, you know, there were certain areas that were sacrosanct where people could not criticize, but other areas where people were allowed to voice their opinions.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Ayman El Mohandas, the Dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and a senior consultant to the United States Agency for International Development. Dr. El Mohandas' appearance was sponsored by the Creighton University Asian World Center as part of the 7th Annual Asian Culture Week. This year's theme was Sustaining Changes in Asia. He spoke on the topic, Change in the Air, What is Next in the Middle East and Beyond? This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 28, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.